Today we're talking with Dean DiDarco about curating and his background in curatorial work. He lives and works in New York City as well as other areas, and we're talking to him today about the curatorial process. Welcome to the show, Dean. Thanks for being here.
Hi, good morning, Brainerd. Thank you.
So I guess the first question I'd like to ask is, what was the first thing that got you into curatorial work? How did you become a curator and begin going down that path?
I guess that I fell into it a little bit by chance. I attended Tyler School of Art. I was studying in the sculpture department there and had a minor in art history. So unlike a lot of other curators, I've been approaching it from the side of someone who has a history as a maker, although I haven't had a studio practice for quite some years now. At the kind of end of my studies at Tyler, I was always the person who was, you know, doing one-off shows and helping people to set up exhibitions, things like that. And it occurred to me at a certain point that that was something that I could actually do, you know, that could be a vocation for me. And so I had a support from a great sculpture department and began doing shows. Some of the first shows I did in Philadelphia were in my apartment, and I would have them open on weekends and things like that. And so from there, things kind of progressed to the point that I actually had decided to kind of switch out of having a studio practice as a sculptor and began working on exhibitions.
And when you say, I mean, just go over that, you had shows in your apartment, that was just after undergraduate school, correct? Is that what Tyler was?
Tyler was undergraduate, yes.
So after undergraduate school, you began mounting shows in your apartment, which was small or large?
It was a small studio apartment. The first exhibition that I did there was, and this was in Philadelphia, was an exhibition called Summer Camping. And, you know, it was a kind of opportunity for me to start to experiment with both the kind of the context for the exhibition being in a domestic setting, which I found later with some projects that I did specifically here in Brooklyn. I had a non-commercial space that was also in what would have been the living room of my apartment, but which was dedicated exhibition space called Parlor Projects, which I ran from 2000 to 2005 and did, I think, about 38 exhibitions there.
So let's talk about Parlor Projects. This is when you moved to New York, and Parlor Projects began, again, in your apartment in New York, which was also a studio?
It was a slightly larger apartment. The way that Parlor Projects came about is I had a roommates, Jennifer Allura and Guillermo Calzadilla, who were artists, and they were moving out, and I had all of a sudden all of this extra space because I decided that I was going to take on the apartment by myself. And I invited a couple people over to ask them what they thought about it, you know, thinking, where do you think I'm going to, you know, where should I put the furniture and all those kinds of things. And people were like, wow, this room gets great light. And I thought, I think I've got to do some programming here. It was shortly after I had moved to New York and was looking for opportunities to do exhibitions and decided, well, this is a way for me to have some dedicated space and to do some programming, and thought that was a very easy way for me to have that space. I was looking actually at lots of work in studios that, because it maybe wasn't commercially viable work, was not really making it into the galleries. There was a lot of work that I was. Parlor Projects was a space where I showed performance and experimental work and interactive work, and that was basically the focus of things. And So there were works in all media, but with a specific attention given to works that were somehow performative or interactive, or the exhibition, say, that an artist had always wanted to do, but, you know, had never been given an opportunity to do. And I wanted to be a space for dialogue, basically.
And financially, how did this work? Did you have any backing or another job? How were you able to support this activity?
I called it an unprofit space. It wasn't a nonprofit and it wasn't a commercial space. I did have a full-time job. I was working as a studio manager for the painter David Reed, and decided that, you know, the projects by and large were all the expenses were shared or out-of-pocket expenses between myself and the artists who were exhibiting. So it wasn't maybe the smartest financial model, but it was definitely a model that I feel generated some much-needed dialogue.
And how did that evolve? It was in your apartment, and did it remain in your apartment, or did you secure another space at some point?
No, it remained in my apartment. The space was open on the weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, as well as by appointment. And it was a point at which there were not so many spaces in Williamsburg. There were, of course, spaces like Pierogi and Four Walls, and certainly, you know, folks like Joe Amrine of Pierogi were real, they kind of set the tone in the neighborhood. And I was a couple stops out from the Bedford stop at Graham Avenue. And so it was also a kind of destination point. It was maybe not the easiest place for people to get to, but I found that by having a kind of domestically sited space, it was very easy for people to come, see exhibitions. There was a lot of kind of sitting around the kitchen table talking about the work that was in the exhibitions. And that created a real opportunity for dialogue to be able to happen.
That sounds wonderful. And how did you get the word out about it? How did it become known and the destination for people to want to come to?
Well, I think a lot of that was that there was a kind of concerted effort between myself and the artists. I was fortunate to have a kind of really great community of artists around who were really supportive. Generally, what I would do was program a series of exhibitions, normally about six at a time, and announce them all at once. The exhibitions generally tended to run between, say, 4 and 6 weeks. And so there was a bit of a kind of opportunity where all of the people involved in these exhibitions would send out information to friends and other contacts. And so things grew in a very organic way. All of the exhibitions were announced via email. I did no mailings. But it quickly kind of grew to where there was a kind of fairly large audience for the exhibitions very early on, which was a real coup.
And what was the first press on that?
I had some coverage early on in the New York Times, but I think also the kind of support that I had from the artist community, artists who were participating in the exhibitions, as well as people in the neighborhood who were just stopping by to see what was happening at the space. The space itself was a fairly small space. It was what would have been the living room of the apartment. And it was just 15 by 20 feet. There was basically one 20-foot long hangable wall. And all the other spaces were, you know, interrupted by doors or by windows. There was a small closet on one wall that was actually later used by the artist Karen Campbell, who did a performance there. So the exhibitions had to be fairly focused, which was a very interesting an interesting part of programming the space, you know, working with those constraints and kind of working to try and challenge this idea that, you know, because the space was small, there was quite a bit of energy that had to be invested into making an exhibition that spoke well.
And so that continued for 5 years, you said?
For 5 years, yeah, from 2000 to 2005.
And the same time you were still, you had a full-time job throughout this time?
I had a full-time job. So it was quite something to, you know, be working full-time through the week. And oftentimes having people come over in the evenings to see exhibitions because I was open as well as the weekends by appointment. So if somebody wanted to come and see an exhibition at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night or at, you know, 10 o'clock on a Thursday, those were all things that were arranged in advance with people who wanted to come and see. So the audiences were pretty varied and pretty diverse because of that. And it was a fun way for me to both to engage and to kind of learn about the work. I think some of the things that I did early on, just in terms of the way that I was programming, were oftentimes there were works, say like the guys from Force Field, who did one of their first exhibitions outside of Providence, Rhode Island, with me at Parlor Projects, and oftentimes, like they did, there was a kind of sense that the entire space could be engaged. So there were oftentimes opportunities where artists would not only use the kind of given gallery space, the living room space, but oftentimes the exhibitions bled into other parts of the house, into the kitchen, into the bathroom. There was a small backyard as well. And things were sited in all of these spaces. And that became a very interesting opportunity to think about the way that, you know, the way that we live with all of these ideas and how that can be an enriching experience.
And I know at one point the curators from the Whitney Museum and at that time the Biennial came to Parlor Projects to select some of the artists. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yes, Chrissy Isles at the Whitney, who is in the film and video department, was a supporter early on and came to see a number of exhibitions, including one that was done by Karen Campbell. Karen did a performance that was called A Place in the World. And for the performance, what Karen did, she performed live for the run of the exhibition. The walls of the living room were painted a kind of minty green color. The closet in the space, which was a kind of built-out closet with sliding doors, was painted a kind of yellow color, almost the kind of yellow of a typical number two pencil. And all of the curtains on the window were taken off, so the space was quite bare. All of the doors were propped open, and what would happen was that when people would be coming into the exhibition space, Karen would be at the windows kind of watching for people coming in, and when people would enter into the space, she would run into the closet, which had been emptied of all of my things, and close the doors. So that was the kind of action that happened. And as people were walking into the space, they would hear this din, they would hear the closet doors closing, and I'd be standing in there and people would say, well, you know, what's happening? And the line was, well, you came into the space and she went into the closet. And there was oftentimes a kind of like, okay, well, you know, now what? And then people would oftentimes just address the closet, talk through the door to Karen, who was inside, and making every effort to not be seen by people. So when people would sometimes try and open the closet door, she'd force it closed. The only object that she had with her was a blue blanket, which she would oftentimes use to cover herself and kind of protect herself from being seen by people who were trying to break their way in.
That's a great image. So go on. So then Chrissy came, and it led up to more curators coming from the Whitney and eventually selecting artists for the biennial. Is that correct?
Correct, yes. So they wrote me an email and asked me about some of the exhibitions that I had done, and asked me, you know, if I could present them with some names. That, I guess, led to some connections being made between Karen Campbell and the guys from Force Field, Jim Drain and R. Peterson, as well as some other exhibitions and some other artists whose names I had presented them with, like Andrea Geyer, who had done an exhibition called Fantasies Are Feelings Given Form, Don't Worry, They're Safe, If Understood. And so some of these artists, Karen and the guys from Force Field, got into the biennial, and Andrea Geyer later was included in the exhibition The American Effect.
Very, very, very interesting story and inspiring. How did you meet a lot of these artists, like Force Field from Providence and Karen Campbell? Some of those sound like they weren't just in the community, but you were pulling them from even out of state.
They were. For instance, the guys from Force Field had come down. I had done an exhibition with an artist named Megan Whitmarsh, who is now based in Los Angeles, but who is living here in Brooklyn at the time. And Megan put together a small comic book and zine called Snow Monkeys. And the guys from Force Field knew about Snow Monkeys and knew about the kind of comics that Megan was making and were fans of her work and came by to see an exhibition of hers that I had up. And in talking with them, I found out a little bit more about what they were doing and was very interested and intrigued, but also didn't quite understand maybe what they were doing. And it was really that desire to understand what their practice was that led to me offering them a show. It was more about trying to have an opportunity perhaps to live with the work. For me, that was one of the things that was very special about Parlor Projects. And so oftentimes it was over that period of being able to be around the work in a kind of ongoing and intimate way that led to these opportunities to, you know, to take chances basically and to say, okay, maybe I don't understand what this is, but that for me was a very good reason to think about trying to program something. You know, that the questions that the work brought up were interesting and intriguing ones for me, and that certainly was one of the things that I often thought about in terms of how I programmed the space.
Huh. Okay.
And then there were other kind of things happening at the space. For instance, the artist Matthew Buckingham had put together a seminar. That was a project that was organized by and large by a friend of mine, the curator Larissa Harris. And Matthew's seminar was called Universal Time and the Present Moment. And it was a seminar that was open to, I think we had 12 or 15 participants. Basically, it was a kind of, we sent out the information about the exhibition and said the first group of people who respond to this email will secure a place in this seminar, which involved a series of readings as well as film screenings that considered the kind of notions and representations of temporality. And so that was a kind of interesting way also to think about what the possibilities were for presenting presenting opportunities for public dialogue. As well, there were some other talks early on. The painter Anouka Faruqi did a kind of recurring talk that happened over 4 weeks. So it was the same talk presented four times to different audiences that was called The Kantian Sublime, Why Care? So these were all kind of ways for me to just think about, well, you know, we normally think about galleries as presenting exhibitions, but I saw it as another way to develop a public dialogue. And it was certainly one of the things that was very exciting about the space. It could be reinvented each time. And the kind of challenges for me were how to kind of keep things live and keep things exciting.
And so how did it end and why did it end? And can you talk about that transition and what happened next?
Well, it ended basically because I found out that I was going to have to move. My landlord, who was an elderly Italian-American guy, had decided that he wanted to sell the building. This was 2005, so the property values in Williamsburg were starting to skyrocket. And he decided that he was going to sell the space and take some time to spend back in Italy. So everybody was saying, like, well, you know, so you're just going to open another space right now. And at that time, things had started to happen where I was being invited to curate other exhibitions in other spaces. And I decided, you know, that I was actually not going to open another space, but was kind of going to take it as an opportunity to do some more independent projects in and around New York.
And what were those independent projects? And sorry to press.
I had done projects
working with you're still working your job and doing other projects. You hadn't moved full time to curating yet, or I don't know if you even are now, but.
Yeah, I wasn't doing curating full time at that point, but I'd been given some opportunities to present some exhibitions at Artist Space and at Art in General. I had also started to do quite a bit more writing. I was asked to contribute catalog essays for the freestyle exhibition that was put together by Studio Museum in Harlem. And wrote about work by Adler Gurrier. So it was a kind of interesting time. And because I think that I was so focused on creating this kind of dialogue, there was certainly a kind of audience that existed outside of the constraints of that space. And I basically had decided that I was going to try and speak to a larger audience in a way that was slightly more itinerant. So it involved kind of creating exhibitions, you know, in other contexts.
And tell me a little bit about how that evolved from that to curating full time.
Well, I guess it's a fairly organic process. I'd been given more and more opportunities. For instance, there was a Raimundas Malasauskas, a curator who is based or was based at the time in Vilnius in Lithuania, had come to the city, was doing visits with artists and asking people, you know, are there spaces that I should see? Who are people that are doing interesting work? And fortunately, people put us in contact. And that led to me being invited to co-curate with him an exhibition at the Center for Contemporary Art in Vilnius in Lithuania that was called 24/7, which was supposed to be an exhibition of work by New York artists. I presented him with the kind of notion that I didn't know what the context was in Vilnius, what kind of work was going to be happening there. And so I asked him if we could organize the possibility for me to go to Vilnius in advance, both to see the exhibition as well as to kind of get a sense of what the artist community was like there and do studio visits, and then have a period of time in between then and the opening of the exhibition to come back and develop ideas so that the work that I presented there would in some way speak to the community of artists that were in place there. And that was a great opportunity. In the end, what I decided to do was to also include other artists from Lithuania. And, you know, that was an effort to kind of extend the dialogue, basically.
And the beginning of doing international curating or curatorial work on a level that was very different than what you had done previously.
Exactly. Yeah, so that growth was a very nice moment for me.
And let me ask you this. A lot of artists are graduating from schools now or have been in their practices for several years and are in the position where they're looking for shows or looking to meet curators. What would you say to those artists in terms of how to engage themselves within the art, not necessarily market, but within the system of art, so that they could meet curators like yourself or other people who they may be able to produce shows with?
Mm-hmm. I think that this is one of those things that always seems a little bit mysterious to people, you know, how all of these introductions happen. For me, the process has always been one that's fairly organic. Oftentimes, it happens by just being out and seeing exhibitions and having an interesting conversation with someone at an opening or while seeing shows. And all of those kinds of things have led to opportunities where I've said, oh, great, I would love to come by the studio, or have been invited to come by someone's studio. And you know, developing a dialogue. I think it's one of those things that I think oftentimes is a bit confusing to people. But ultimately, I think if you're working hard in the studio and really getting things done, I think that there are always kind of opportunities. One of the things that I did very early on was just as a curator, I feel like in as much as I'm trying to generate dialogue, it's also very much about paying attention to artists. So oftentimes when I would do a studio visit with someone, and this was actually a kind of fairly regular part of what I would consider my practice, I would send them an email after a studio visit and say, will you recommend another person to get in contact with me for a visit? And so it was a way to not always be the person that was choosing who to go see, but in a way kind of introduced an element of chance in some sense, where another artist who I had some kind of dialogue with had recommended somebody to visit. And then, of course, you know, there was a visiting that person and asking them for their recommendations of who to visit. And in that way, it grew in an almost rhizomatic fashion. So it was not so much about, you know, me necessarily making choices about who to see, but presenting opportunities for other people to also generate those connections between myself and other artists.
Okay, so I think that's helpful for a lot of people to hear, because like you say, it does seem to be often a mysterious process. But if I'm correct in understanding what you're saying, it's to immerse themselves in the scene to begin with, to go to openings and to begin talking and just get interested in what's happening out there. And
And yes, certainly to kind of, you know, develop your community. If there are people that you have interesting dialogues with, there must certainly be other people who, you know, who they have connections to. And, you know, just to be able to start to kind of draw those connections out in a larger way. That's always been, for me, one of the very important things that I've focused on.
Okay, that's really, this has been a great talk, Dean. In closing, I'd like to hear a little bit about your transition to a full-time curator, which is what you're doing now. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. I'm doing independent curatorial work. I guess now some of the things that are on the plate for me are that I am getting ready to go to Montreal. There's a space called Fonderie Darling, the Darling Foundry, that's based in Montreal that has a residency for curators of the Americas. And I applied to this program and was accepted. So I'll be spending 2 months in Montreal, some time to both kind of get to know what the community of artists is like there, as well as to just focus and do some writing, and kind of develop all of the ideas that have been, you know, bubbling away in pots on the back of the stove, and to just have some time to focus on that. I also have an exhibition up right now at the Rockland Center for the Arts called In Place of Process that includes work by Catherine Hubbard, Yoko Inoue, and Anissa Mack. And I'm currently working on an exhibition that'll open on the 7th of May at the gallery Higher Pictures here in New York. And that's an exhibition called 50 Artists Photograph the Future. As well, I guess I've been working on doing some scholarship and research on the French artist Gina Pane, and who was a performer. She was born in 1939 and died in 1992, and doing some really incredible performance work, very much kind of associated with issues around the body, as well as kind of issues of public anguish and pain. And I was fortunate enough to be given a curatorial research fellowship by the French government, an organization called the French American Cultural Exchange, to spend 3 months in Paris, in which time I was doing a lot of research. I was in contact with her partner who manages her archive and was able to go there and kind of delve deeper into her work.
Wow.
So these are a few of the things that are in process for me right now.
That sounds very exciting, Dean. In closing, is there anything you'd like to say to the largely artist audience that's listening to this about their own process or interest as they continue their studio practice in the art world?
Well, I would say that, you know, one of the things that I'm very much dedicated to as a curator is to creating dialogue. And I think that there are oftentimes ways for these dialogues to be generated by kind of going back to one's own community and to thinking about connections that can be drawn between contacts, between friends, and all of these kind of things. And I think that it's very important to develop not only as individually and to be working hard in the studio, but to kind of think about how that work in the studio can be applied in larger contexts and for other kinds of conversations to happen. And so I think that one of the ways to do that is to just always kind of keep an active dialogue with other people, a kind of an audience of people who you have, you know, very interesting conversations with. And I think that just generating those conversations both with people who will challenge you as well as to be able to speak kind of clearly and critically about your work is certainly always an important and very valuable thing.
I think so too. That generates a community and an intellectual vitality that's very stimulating to everyone.
Certainly does, yeah. And in as much as I think, you know, as, you know, artists, it's really about kind of, you know, using a certain kind of, I think there's oftentimes in art a kind of economy of communication, that, you know, making a work is about being able to communicate some ideas to a larger public, say, than the way that we do when we have a conversation. And so in as much as that kind of economy exists, you know, how much easier it is, say, for a number of people to look at a video or a painting or see a performance. That kind of dialogue is really invaluable.
Thanks so much, Dean, for your time today on this program and talking to all of us. I'm really grateful for your insights and sharing your history and conversations that you've had with a lot of interesting artists in your curatorial practice. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Brainerd.